The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
What is it?
Raiders, sir.
Is this Captain Lund? Who are you and what the hell do you think you're doing?
Taking your ship, sir, in the name of Sacred Liberty and the New Tex Militia.
Do this. You won't get away with it.
Not a single shred of decency, but what can you expect of that sort?
Abomination.
What perversions have they bred into her?
Slut.
They will destroy you. They will come after me and blow you to bits.
Someday your luck will run out.
Someday you'll be helpless.
Someday you'll be stuck.
And what will you do then?
You are thinking still that you will be rescued, but you have already spoken the last words you will ever speak.
Never.
We'll need the slicer, boys.
Welcome to the real world.
Serrano Legacy, Book 5, Rules of Engagement, Part 1. Available now from Graphic Audio.
The clock is ticking on an ecological disaster.
1 minute. Let's go.
The chemicals have been rerouted to fill the silos outside the building. We need only set the charges and blow up the silos to pour the contents into the ocean and the air itself.
Time is running out, and we don't want to be here when the bombs go off.
Somebody sabotaged a tugboat and garbage scow in the Hudson only a mile or so from Manhattan. Two other similar attacks occurred at a chemical plant in Japan and an oil well off the coast of Scotland.
Somebody is deliberately attacking the environment?
That's what the president thinks.
The Stony Man teams fight a war on three fronts against terrorists who hold the environment hostage in an ambitious play for world power.
We are trying to force the hand of the entire world to do our bidding.
First, we have to make certain the world realizes they are powerless to stop us, and no place will be safe from us.
With help from Mac Bolan and American ninja John Trent, the forces of Stony Man set out to thwart a plan to put control of the Earth's resources into the hands of a consortium of power-hungry criminals.
One does not do favors without a reason. What would I get in return for assisting you?
You're not going to arrest me or accuse me in any way for the actions of the terrorists?
Not if you cooperate.
We want to buy into your organization. Let's say 45 million Deutschmarks.
What exactly would you want for this investment?
Oh, this is driving me nuts. Who the hell are we up against?
So far, we haven't found much except the terrorists have remained several moves ahead of us.
Then we're just gonna have to catch up with them.
Better suit up for jungle combat. We're not going on a picnic, fellas.
What is it?
I could have sworn I saw...
Ambush! Brace yourself. We're going down, mate.
Going down?
Rather fast.
The piers of New York, the pubs of Scotland, the boulevards of Paris, and the seamy backstreets of Osaka lead the executioner and the forces of Stony Man Farm to the rainforests of the Amazon, twisting arms and calling in favors all the way to a deadly showdown. Don't miss a world of action in Stony Man number 6.
Goodbye. It has been a pleasure.
And now, our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter. Narrated by Ken Jackson. With performances by James Konacek, Sonny Lasky, Eric Messner, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Tim Getman, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Kate Foster, Richard Rowan, Dylan Lynch, Terrence Aislefort, Tony Nam, Mort Shelby, Elizabeth Demery, Lily Beacon, Michael Glenn, Elizabeth Jernigan, Joe Brack, Jeff Baker, Peter Stray, Johann Detweiler, and Greg Reinfeld. The Last Gunfighter, number 9, No Man's Land.
Frank heard the wagons long before they came into view, and he smelled them before he heard them. The odor of soap and other fancy stinkum hit his nose hard in contrast to the periodic whiff of cottonwood on the windswept Kansas plains. Wolf, the scruffy cur that sat by his side, smelled it too and whined softly, looking up at his master. Soap meant women, and more often than not, women meant trouble. Frank sat on the knife ridge overlooking what passed for a trail and watched the slow procession of wagons. 5 big, fine Conestoga prairie schooners, each pulled by 6 stout red Missouri mules. A lone rider, likely the wagon master, rode scout about 100 yards ahead of the lead team. 5 mounted men flanked the train, 3 on one side of the wagons, 2 on the other. Each man carried a rifle across the pommel of his saddle, ready for use. When the lead rider drew within hailing distance, Frank lifted his reins and urged Stormy, his big Appaloosa, down the incline to intercept him. Rocks and loose gravel skittered around the horse's hooves as they slid down the hillside. The scout spotted Frank and lifted his left arm, halting the train. His right hand dropped to the butt of his pistol. Frank reined up, raised his hands, and smiled.
No need for that, friend. I mean you no harm.
Stay your business.
Just some company on the trail. Maybe some coffee and a speck of conversation when you decide to make camp for the evening.
You alone?
I am what you see, friend.
Look at the jog, Mama.
A girl of 5 or 6 with blonde braids stuck her head out of the canvas flap of the lead wagon.
Does he bite?
Another girl called from the driver's seat of the next wagon in line. This one was older, well into her teens, with frizzled red hair the color of a carrot. Wolf sat on his haunches beside Stormy, studying the girls. He didn't move. Frank tipped his hat to the young ladies.
Only bites if you try to do them harm. Told you there were women out here.
We're about to find a place to make camp. You familiar with this country?
Not too much. Been heading west for the better part of a week, staying out of the strip.
The wagon master turned in the saddle to look around him.
We're out of the strip, I think.
About 10 miles, I'd say.
Good. That's a blessing, anyhow. You got a name?
I do. Frank Morgan.
The wagon master looked like somebody had pulled the plug and drained all the color out of him.
Hey, everybody! We got Frank Morgan here paying us a visit!
That got everyone's attention. Those in the wagons nearest the two men sat and stared in silence at the West's most famous gunfighter.
I'm not on the prod for anyone, just drifting, seeing the country.
You planning on riding along with us, Mr. Morgan?
Unless you have an objection.
There was something about the wagon boss that didn't fit with his smile. He looked Frank over like he was sizing him up for a fight. His left eyebrow was crooked and white as a sheet. A thin scar ran up through the middle of it, crossed his forehead, and disappeared again under his hat. It made the man look like he was in a state of a perpetual scowl.
You'd be welcome. Steve Wilson.
The man held out a hand. Frank shook the friendship hand and then fell in beside the other man on point as the wagons began to lumber along behind them again.
Fine-looking wagons.
Frank began the sizing-up process he did when he met anyone new. It was what had kept him alive for so long. This Wilson character seemed mighty preoccupied with something.
Huh?
The wagons. With the West building up since the war, and the railroads coming over, I don't see wagons as much as I used to. These look to be good ones.
Aren't they, though? All of them special built in Indiana for this trip. They've served us well. Got us this far without too much trouble.
Where are you headed?
Colorado. In another week or so, we'll turn north some, and then it's on to our new home.
Farmers?
Frank caught Wilson staring at the Colt Peacemaker on his hip. Wilson nodded.
You bet. And we're good farmers, too. It's in our blood. Just getting too crowded back in Indiana. We all wanted some space where we could stretch out some. Build a place to call our own.
Frank looked at the man's hands. They were strong hands, but didn't have the calluses he'd expect of a farmer. Wilson had been on the trail a while, though, so Frank dismissed the notion that the man might be lying.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm partial to the wide open spaces myself.
Yeah, that's a fine-looking horse you're riding, Mr. Morgan. I don't believe I've ever seen one quite like it.
Appaloosa, Mr. Wilson. Nez Perce Indian breed him.
Beautiful animal. Very striking.
They rode on for a few hundred yards without speaking. Only the creak of the wagons and groan of saddle leather broke the silence. As they topped a small rise, Frank pointed to a hollow below them.
Looks like a nice little creek down there, Mr. Wilson. Plenty of firewood, forage for the stock. Good spot for camp, wouldn't you say?
Looks good to me too, Mr. Morgan. I'll ride back and tell the others.
Before you do, Mr. Wilson, I'd like to propose a suggestion.
Certainly.
The man tensed and seemed to hold his breath at what might be in store. Frank couldn't be certain, but it almost looked like the man was getting ready to draw his gun.
Let's you and me drop this Mr. business before we wear each other out. I'm Frank, and you're Steve. What do you say?
Well, sounds good to me, Frank. You've got a deal.
Wilson spun his horse and trotted back over the ridge to bring up the wagons.
What do you think, Wolf? Am I getting too jumpy? Or is that man hiding something?
A few minutes later, Frank squatted by the creek and watched as Wilson positioned the wagons on a flat in a tight circle.
A man appears to know his business. Maybe he is just what he said he is.
The men in the group tended to the stock, while women drew water from the creek for cooking and drinking. Once the huge oak barrels on each wagon were filled, the children led the horses and mules down to drink. Frank helped gather wood for the cook fire, ignoring the surprised looks he received from the men. The women thanked Frank in hushed tones, and the children followed him around, the young boys trying to emulate his walk. Once the stock was settled and the firewood was gathered, the women dragged out camp ovens and busied themselves with their mixing, stirring, and kneading. Rich smells of meat and gravy filled the still air as the men sat down to cups of fresh brewed coffee and conversation. Wilson introduced the families in turn. Abel and Carolyn Brandon and their three children, two girls in their teens and a boy of about 10, each with freckles and frizzy carrot-colored hair, just like their mother. Weldon Freeman and his wife Paula, with three blonde girls that stair-stepped from 5 to 13. Randall and Judith Fossman were the oldest couple, with two boys in their teens and twin 15-year-old girls. Harry and Betty Ellington had a boy and a girl, neither over 10 years old. A sour-looking fellow named Virgil Carpenter and his family rounded out the group. He had two daughters, and his wife's name was Dixie.
My mother liked the name Dixie.
Well, I don't. The word leaves a bad taste in my mouth. I call her by her middle name. Lou. Guess it comes from my time in the damn war. I was just a boy, really, but I killed me my share of them damn stinking Rebs.
Carpenter took a sip of his coffee and eyed Frank over the rim of his cup.
You fight in the war, Morgan?
Yes, I did. And, I believe I'll call you Dixie.
Before Carpenter could say anything else, Frank looked over at Mr. Brandon.
Y'all have some fine-looking mules, Abel. The plow broke.
Well, I suppose they are. I mean, of course their plow broke.
Silence fell around the camp for a few moments. The women whispered among themselves.
I suppose we should level with you, Frank. You're a smart enough man to figure out any one of us know anything about farming.
Wilson?
Weldon Freeman cocked his head to one side and gave the wagon master a tight-jawed look. The wagon master waved him off.
Oh, it's all right. I know a bit more about the famous Mr. Morgan than you folks. Read a long article about him in the St. Louis paper a while back. Seems he's a rich man. Got more money than all of us put together. He's got no need to steal from us. Isn't that right, Frank?
I reckon I'm worth considerable, for a fact.
Betty Ellington smoothed her apron out in her lap and began to fuss with her daughter's braids.
If you have so much money, why are you out here? Don't you have a real home?
Frank grinned. Something that seemed so simple to him was always so hard for others to understand.
I have all this.
He waved his hands at the sky and plains around them.
But don't you want more?
I have a nice little place in the mountains west of here. I reckon I'll retire there someday. Maybe raise cattle and a few horses. That's years down the road.
So for now, you just drift?
I enjoy life.
And take a life occasionally, so I hear.
When I'm pushed.
Frank turned to the wagon master.
So, if I may be so bold, if you're not going to Colorado to farm, what are you folks up to?
We're going to hunt for gold.
Gold?
Yes, sir. Gold. In the Sangre de Cristo Mountains west of Canyon City. According to Mr. Wilson, only a few people know about it. We plan to be among the first to stake our claims.
I suppose that could be gold country, but it's also Ute country.
Oh, I hear tell the Utes aren't much of a problem to go fussing over anymore. Besides, these folks are plenty capable. They can handle themselves very well.
I see.
Frank carefully studied the wagon master. The nagging feeling that something about Steve Wilson didn't ring true tugged at Frank again, but he let his suspicion slide for the moment. He sat quietly, drank his coffee, and listened to the others talk about their hopes for gold. The longer they talked, the more Frank wanted to know about Steve Wilson. He was beginning to take on the slimy air of a snake oil salesman, and Frank wondered how much these poor folks had paid for his services.
I know of a way that'll take days off your trip, if you're interested, that is.
Oh, I don't think so. I know this way. I think it would be best to stick with the route we planned.
Just a thought. Say, this is mighty good coffee. Mind if I have another cup?
Certainly, Mr. Morgan.
Much obliged, ma'am. I'm a coffee-drinking man, for a fact.
The woman smiled, her roundish face reflecting the firelight. She'd taken off her bonnet after sundown, and her auburn hair hung in loose locks around her cheeks. Her skin was pinked with the color of health. Though her eldest daughter was nearly grown, Dixie Carpenter retained the shapely figure of a much younger woman. Frank found himself wondering if sour old Virgil even noticed her figure anymore. He had yet to see the man smile. Frank leaned back against a water barrel and listened. He was conscious of Dixie's eyes occasionally touching him, too often to be an accident. At first, he made a few feeble attempts to avoid her gaze, but finally gave in to it completely. There were questions on her face, and if Frank surmised correctly, a number of silent promises. No one else appeared to notice the silent conversation. Frank bit his lip and tried to shake off the feelings that seized him. She was another man's wife. This could lead to nothing but trouble. Abel Brandon's voice rescued Frank from his own thoughts.
You plan on riding along with us for a ways, Mr. Morgan?
No, I don't believe I'd better. Think I'll pull out come morning. But I want to warn you folks, stay out of the strip just south of us. It's a mean place, full of all sorts of lowlifes.
I plan to steer well clear of no man's land. Don't worry about us in that regard.
I thought you were going to ride with us for a time, Mr. Morgan.
I changed my mind, Mrs. Carpenter. That's the beauty of riding alone. A man can shift directions like the wind.
Frank cut his eyes to Wilson. A look of relief had washed across the wagon master's drawn face, and his bent, snowy eyebrow had come down some. Something was definitely wrong here. Very wrong. The next morning, just before dawn, as Frank knelt rolling up his blankets, Dixie Carpenter slipped through the mist beside the cottonwoods where he had camped.
Mrs. Carpenter, you're up awful early.
You said you were a coffee-drinking man. I hated for you to slip off without one last cup. Sorry, it's a little strong. Warmed up from last night.
Frank took the offered cup and sipped it.
Oh, wonderful. And much appreciated. As is the company. Is something on your mind, Mrs. Carpenter?
And I thought you were going to call me Dixie.
I did say that for a fact. So, Dixie, what, besides your good manners and desire to serve me coffee, brings you out so early this morning?
I don't trust that Mr. Wilson.
Frank raised a brow at that and cocked back his hat.
What does your husband think about him?
Virgil's basically a good man, but he is no smarter than a tree stump. Wilson has him completely hoodwinked. He thinks the man hung the moon in the stars. But I know different.
What makes you so suspicious?
He's... well, devious, Mr. Morgan.
Devious?
When I asked about other groups he's guided west, he became defensive. Almost surly. I don't know how to explain it. He's oily. Oily, that's the best word I can think of.
Frank nodded and drained the last of his coffee.
Well, he won't give you a straight answer?
No. He says everyone he's taken west is likely spread all over and he doesn't know where they are.
Spread out could well be true.
I know it could, but I still don't trust him. We're carrying a lot of money, Mr. Morgan. All of us are. We sold everything we had to come on this trip, and some of us took sizable sums from the bank. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I am frightened something is going to happen.
Who's out there? That you, Morgan?
Wilson sauntered into view out of the fog and raised an eyebrow when he saw Dixie.
This sort of thing could lead to trouble, Morgan. She's a married woman.
Mrs. Carpenter was kind enough to bring me a cup of coffee before I pulled out. Nothing to get knotted up over.
Then I beg pardon. From both of you. I was wrong in assuming the worst.
Dixie took the cup and held out her hand.
I'm glad we met, Mr. Morgan. I hope you find whatever it is you're seeking.
Frank gently took the hand.
Thank you, ma'am. You and the others have a safe journey.
Dixie disappeared into the early morning shadows.
So, Morgan, you pulling out then?
That I am.
Frank lifted the stirrup leather to tighten the cinch on his saddle. He turned his back on Wilson.
Right now, as a matter of fact.
Maybe we'll meet again.
Frank picked up each of Stormy's feet to check for stones.
I'd count on it, Mr. Wilson.
What's that supposed to mean?
Means we're heading the same direction. Taking two different trails to get there. Nothing more.
Oh. Yeah, I see.
Wilson turned and walked away without another word. Frank swung into the saddle and patted his horse on the neck.
Something about that fella makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. What do you think, Wolf? That's what I thought. All right, boy, let's travel.
Three days after Frank Morgan drifted away from the wagon train, Dixie Carpenter slapped the thick leather reins and whistled to start the mules. The terrain had changed little in the ensuing days. Virgil and the other men rode out to the sides of the wagons, scouting for game and signs of trouble. Wilson spent all his time out front. The train rumbled along at an agonizingly slow pace, creeping up low hills and slipping down shallow valleys that all melted into one long red and gray formless plain. At least the men got to look at something different. Dixie and the other women didn't get to see much except the back end of the mules. The shorter wheel animal nearest her reminded her of Virgil. It was strong enough, but endowed with a permanent scowl and more than content to do nothing but follow in the traces behind the others. He put his back into it when he absolutely had to, but never seemed to get excited about much of anything. The lead mule on the right was a big red beast with a kind face and a soft eye. This particular mule had a look that seemed to always wander along the horizon, looking for adventure. It pulled with a vengeance when in harness, and ate and played with gusto when turned out at the end of the day. This mule reminded her of Frank Morgan. No matter how hard she fought the thought, ever since he'd ridden away on his beautiful spotted horse, she'd felt as if a part of her was missing. Of course, she knew it was a stupid notion, but no matter how she tried to busy her mind, it always returned to thoughts of the handsome drifter. He was was tall, with strong shoulders, and had just enough gray in his dark hair to give him the dignified look of a man who knew things, a man who'd been places besides Indiana and this barren plain. But it was more than that. Frank Morgan had a way about him that made all the others sit up and take notice. The men were all a little afraid of him, and the women were curious about him. And it wasn't just his name, either. Dixie had heard the name of the famous gunfighter, but dime novels weren't on her reading list, and she had no more than a passing knowledge of him. There was a presence that followed the man wherever he went, a stoic strength that comforted and frightened at the same time.
Everything all right, Dixie?
The wagon master trotted up next to her wagon and reined in his horse to match her speed. Dixie. That was a switch. He'd never been so bold before as to call her by her first name.
Everything's fine, Mr. Wilson. Why do you ask?
I don't know. You seem sort of preoccupied since your friend left. That's all.
There was something different about him. It was as if all his manners and social pretense had dissolved as soon as Frank Morgan had ridden away.
I was under the impression he was a friend to all of us, Mr. Wilson.
That's a fact. I guess he is. More to some than others, I would wager. Well, a good day to you then.
Wilson put the spurs to his horse and trotted back to take the lead. Dixie shivered in spite of the intense sun that beat down on the desolate plain before the wagon train. The wagon master was up to no good. None of the men appeared to notice him, but in the days since Frank had gone, there was a bounce to Wilson's step, as if he knew something was about to happen. When she tried to bring it up with Virgil, he dismissed her concerns, but the women could see it. They could tell something had changed. Wilson was cocky and outspoken with the children, and bossy, even sometimes flirtatious with the women when none of their husbands were around. That very morning, Carolyn Brandon had taken a tumble off her wagon when her mules shied at a rattlesnake. All the men had been off hunting, and Wilson was alone with the train. Dixie was in the wagon directly behind and had heard her scream. By the time she'd gotten back to the poor woman, Wilson was off his horse, standing over her, staring down and grinning like the lecher Dixie now knew he was. Carolyn's dress had caught on the brake handle, and a good deal of it had ripped away, leaving her stripped down to her flannels.
Steve Wilson, you go on. Get away from here.
When Dixie had shooed the man away, he'd just glared at her and gotten back on his horse, smiling and taking his own sweet time about it. Something bad was about to happen. Dixie Carpenter just knew it. Steve Wilson was up to something. She couldn't put her finger on it, but she knew it surely as she knew she could trust the handsome drifter. She could feel it deep in her soul. The auburn-haired woman shielded her eyes with an open hand and searched the horizon. She knew the odds were against it, but hoped against hope that she might spot a lone rider on an Appaloosa horse.
Frank Morgan, where are you when I need you?
Frank stayed about 5 miles north of the wagon train, paralleling their route. Occasionally, after topping a low hill, he could just make out the dust kicked up by the mules and the wheels of the heavy wagons. It was slow going, for the train could only make 8 miles a day, and that was if everything went right. On the fourth morning out, just before dawn, Frank lay in his bedroll trying to chase thoughts of Dixie Carpenter from his mind. Wolf sat up suddenly. Faint popping sounds carried in on the morning breeze. Gunfire? Frank lay still for several minutes, straining to hear anything that might tell him what was happening. Nothing. The sun was pinking the eastern sky when he slipped out of his blankets, put on his hat, and tugged on his boots. He stood up and buckled his gun belt. He built a small sage fire to boil water and make coffee. He looked over at Wolf. The big cur sat on his haunches, ears pricked, staring to the south.
So I did hear something, eh, boy?
Frank dumped coffee in the pot of boiling water, then added a bit of cold water to settle the grounds. While he was waiting, He sliced some bacon and laid the thick strips in a small frying pan. He had some pan bread left over from his supper. Wolf suddenly left the clearing in a burst of energy and returned a few minutes later with a jackrabbit in his mouth.
So, we both had breakfast, eh, boy? You want me to cook that thing?
Wolf gave him a low look and clamped his mouth down tighter on the rabbit. He trotted over to the edge of camp, flopped down, and proceeded to dine.
Didn't think so.
Smiling, he poured his coffee and then rolled a cigarette. He leaned back against his saddle and decided that when he had good daylight, he'd ride south a ways and take a look at things, satisfy his curiosity about the shots. They were probably nothing. Maybe he'd just dreamed them. Frank often dreamt of gunfire. Frank found the wagon tracks and followed them west for a mile. Buzzards circled on the heated morning air above the rise ahead of him. Frank set his jaw and urged Stormy into a quick trot. He shook his head sadly when he topped the rise. A large party of men, 20 or so judging by the tracks, had jumped the train as they camped for the night. The wagons and livestock were gone. It didn't take Frank long to discover the bodies. The dead had been piled up in a dry creek bed, and one wall of sand and dirt had been caved in over them. He prodded the pile with a stick and discovered it was only the men and boys. The kids had all been shot in the head. The poor little 10-year-old Brandon boy looked like he was sleeping. The men had suffered various wounds. The body of Steve Wilson was nowhere to be found. Frank covered the bodies again and marked the mass grave with a large mound of rocks. He stood for a moment, grimly considering the scene before him. He'd been right not to trust the wagon master, Steve Wilson, but he'd never expected him to be up to something like this. Any outlaw that would do such a thing to helpless children needed to be hunted down and killed. The women were gone.
Some of them are just babies. Damn it.
Frank didn't want to admit it, but he worried the most about Dixie. Frank calmed down a bit and made a small smokeless fire for coffee while he began to work out a plan. It would be no problem tracking the outlaws. The heavy prairie schooners left ruts deep enough to plant corn. Even a city slicker could follow them. He smoked a cigarette and drank a couple of cups of coffee, letting his rage boil down to a mentally manageable level. What kind of a man was this Steve Wilson? What kind of a human being would travel 1,000 miles with people, men, women, and children, get to know them, share their food, enjoy their hospitality, and then coolly and dispassionately kill them? It would take some sort of inhuman creature, a monster. Thinking about it made Frank's anger return, and he felt the bitter taste of bile in the back of his throat. He fought the feelings, pushed them back. He wanted the hot coals he felt banked for the job ahead. He didn't need a white-hot rage riding on his shoulders. It got in the way of clear thinking. Frank finished the coffee, carefully put out the fire, then tightened Stormy's cinch. He looked down at Wolf.
Let's go save us some women, boy.
Frank kept Stormy at a ground-eating dog trot, and he made much better time than the outlaws with the wagons. It took him only a few miles before he could smell the dust kicked up by the caravan. After the attack, the killers had taken the wagons hard left, and Frank figured they were now well into the desolate strip of lawless territory known as No Man's Land. Frank halted below the crest of a long rise, ground-tied Stormy, and looped the pack horse's lead to a shrubby bit of sage. He took out his binoculars to study the situation. The wagons were stopped all in a straight line. Outlaws sprawled all over the place, sleeping, drinking, and playing cards. A trickle of a stream ran nearby, but it was awfully early to set up a camp. They appeared to be waiting for something, or somebody. The horses were all on one picket line strung between two of the wagons. The big chestnut Wilson had been riding was nowhere to be found. At first, Frank couldn't figure out where the women were, but a man in a scruffy gray hat walked around one of the wagons and lowered the tailgate. He motioned with his hand, and women and girls began to climb to the ground. Frank counted them, trying to remember how many daughters everyone had. As near as he could figure, they were all accounted for. His hopes rose when he saw Dixie jump down from the wagon. Her hat was off, and her auburn hair shined in the air. Frank studied the group through his long lenses and could see the girls and Mrs. Fossman were crying uncontrollably. The man in the gray slouch hat sneered and used his boot to shove the women out into the brush. At first, Frank thought the women were done for and held his breath. But the outlaws didn't do anything but push the women around. One slapped the youngest Brandon girl, knocking her to the ground. Frank backed away from his vantage point and rolled over on his back, looking at Wolf.
Oh, we can't do anything until dark, boy. Hell, I'm not even certain I can do anything then. But I aim to do something, even if it's wrong.
Mounting up again, Frank made a wide circle, ending up about a mile from the outlaw camp in a little draw. He cleaned his guns twice, and every hour shimmied up to the edge and removed his hat to check on the situation. The outlaws seemed to be in no hurry to move. Frank wondered about that. What were they waiting for? What did they have planned for the women and girls? Sell them, no doubt. But to whom? Comancheros? Not this far north. Other outlaws in no man's land? Now that was certainly a possibility. Maybe that's where Wilson had gone, to fetch those that wanted to look over the merchandise. Frank shook his head. Wilson was as sorry as they came. He'd met bad men before, too many of them to count. Men who would kill a man for a nickel and laugh about it in front of his kids. Life came cheap to such men, and cheapened their own worth in the bargain. The more they gave up their value for life, the more worthless they became. Wilson was one of those men. One of the worst. Worthless as dung in the street. As he lay in the little draw, Frank witnessed something that shook him down to his boots. Judith Fossman seemed to be in a heated argument with one of the outlaws. The man had shoved one of her girls, and Judith, her mother's rage ignited, slapped him hard across the face. The man backed away a step, put his hand to his jaw, then calmly pulled his pistol and shot her. He showed no more emotion than if he'd been at the supper table and asked someone to pass the beans.
Dear Lord.
Frank watched the Fossman girls run to where their mother lay and throw themselves on the lifeless body. The outlaw scum jerked the girls to their feet and shoved them back toward the wagon. Other outlaws gathered around and laughed, pointing at the dead woman. Some of the men began to tease the killer and gesture to the edge of the camp. Half-heartedly, he grabbed the dead woman by the arms, dragged her out of the camp, and dumped her unceremoniously in a shallow ditch.
Whatever you plan to do, Frank, it has to be tonight. You can't allow this to go on.
Dixie Carpenter sat on a sack of mule oats, a prisoner in the back of her own wagon. Her two girls, Laura and Faith, were about the same age as the Fossman twins. They had their mother's fortitude, but the death of their father had been devastating. The killers hadn't made them watch, but they hadn't warned them to look away either. No one had dared speak when the outlaws had stopped and marched all the men and boys out into the little clearing beyond the line of bushes. Even after the kidnapping and the cruel shooting of Abel Brandon, who tried to stop the evil men, even after that, the women had not dared to think their husbands, fathers, their brothers and sons would be marched off and shot. Dixie wept when she thought about it, wept for the unspeakable cruelty of it all, and the uncertainty of her own daughter's future. Everyone had suffered a loss. The wagon train had melded into a tight-knit family over the hundreds of miles they traveled together. Grown men had become uncles and friends, and boys had become brothers and sons to each of the women and girls. For the first little while, Dixie had felt nothing but shock. Pure, miserable grief had followed, and she had cried just as hard as all the other women. Now, in the back of her wagon, watching her daughters and wondering what would become of them, she felt just hollow, without hope. Virgil's death had been a hard thing to take. They were not the happiest of all couples, but in Dixie's mind, marriage wasn't all about bliss and happiness. It was about raising a family and building something good. Now any hope of that was gone. The brutality of her husband's murder and all the killings had taken its toll on each of the women. Judith Fossman had gone mad immediately. She had moaned and sobbed and shrieked at her tormentors until they'd finally shot her, deciding that she wasn't worth the trouble or the price they might get for her. Poor Carolyn Brandon, who'd watched as not only her husband but her 10-year-old son were murdered on the desolate Kansas prairie, hadn't spoken a word since the incident. Paula Freeman wept and tried to console her 3 daughters at the loss of their father, who doted on all 4 of them like they were his prized golden-haired jewels. Dixie just felt hollow. That damned Frank Morgan kept popping into her mind. For the better part of the morning after the killings, she'd cursed the famous gunfighter for leaving them to fall prey to such a slaughter. But the more she'd heard Wilson gloat over his victory, the more she was glad Morgan had moved on. There were too many of them, and they'd struck with such speed and force that even Morgan would have surely fallen to their bullets. Harry Ellington had killed 2 of the outlaws. For his bravery, he'd been left to die slowly with the other dead, shot in the belly. Dixie had no idea why they'd stopped. Wilson had ridden off shortly after the ambush, and she assumed they were waiting for him.
Pull it together, Dixie.
It was miserably hot and stuffy under the canvas awning of the wagon. The sun beat down unmercifully and shone through in dozens of tiny nicks and holes in the gray covering. Some of the holes were from outlaw bullets. Dixie tried to occupy her mind by imagining what she might do to Wilson if she ever had the chance. She tried to think back on her departed husband, but on each attempt, Frank Morgan's face came drifting into her thoughts. She wondered where he'd gone, wondered where he was right now. He was fond of her. A woman could tell these things. There'd been a look in his steel-gray eyes that said he was put on Earth to take care of things, maybe even take care of her.
Huh?
It was noticeably darker outside, and a cool breath of wind drifted in through the back flap. There was a muddy smell of rain on it. She chanced to peek outside and saw outlaws checking the picket ropes and then horses in advance of the approaching storm. A white squall line moved in front of a black cloud to the northwest, kicking up a column of dust in front of it. Lightning rent the gunmetal sky and sent the smell of sulfur ahead on the wind. Thunder shook the ground and the wagons with it, and all the killers looked up at the approaching storm at the same time. Instantly, Dixie felt a calm come over her, as if she'd been enveloped by a warm quilt. Morgan was coming for her. Somehow she knew it, as certain as rain fell from the sky. She looked at the rank killers out there with the horses and smiled at the thought of what the gunfighter would do to them when he came. Frank watched from his hiding spot in the low draw as a lone rider appeared just after noon. He'd wanted it to be Steve Wilson so he could take care of everything in one fell swoop. No such luck. Frank figured as much. Wilson was the type to let others do his dirty work. Within minutes of the new arrival, the outlaws had their cinches tightened and the mules reharnessed. They looked to be making for a stand of cottonwoods about 2 miles away. Cottonwoods generally meant water, and with the approaching storm, the train might have to hole up for a while. Dixie and the rest of the women had been herded back inside the wagons shortly after the Fossman woman was killed. Frank hadn't seen Dixie since. He stayed well back to keep from being spotted, but the outlaws looked to be a lot more worried about the storm ahead of them than anyone who might be on their trail. It took the better part of an hour for them to reach the line of trees. Frank left Stormy and the pack horse tied to an abandoned wagon wheel and ran forward a quarter mile at a half crouch to watch the outlaws make camp. he was pleased to see they circled the wagons, for although it made a neat fortress against marauding Indians, it would also group most of his entire quarry together, making his job a little easier. He doubted they would even post much of a guard. From the snake-level vantage point of his belly, Frank could see the women had been allowed out of the wagons again. The wind was in his face, and occasionally he could hear the gruff barks and shouts of the outlaws as they harassed and cajoled the prisoners into making a hasty supper before the rain got to them. Frank estimated there were 17 men. Some of them moved with the cocksure swagger of boys in their teens. Others moseyed like they had a few years' experience. Frank made it a point to watch where the older men spent their time, planning to spend his first rounds on them. With any luck, he could spook some of the boys and run them off. He'd been motionless for so long, forming the battle plan in his head, that Frank didn't notice the ambling coyote until it was almost on top of him. The poor animal, startled out of his skin, nearly turned inside out trying to turn and run the opposite way. Wolf gave chase, but luckily, the hapless coyote turned away from the wagons. Luckily for Frank, that is. With Wolf after him, the coyote didn't stand a chance. Frank made his way back to his horses and prepared for an attack at nightfall. After what he'd seen, he didn't intend to give any quarter. He didn't so much have a concrete set of plans as an attitude. He'd ride in slowly, loaded for bear, and see what transpired. By and large, outlaws were an easy bunch to spook in the dark. They lived a life that had them constantly looking over their shoulders, constantly on guard. It was a tiresome existence and made them prone to jerking the trigger instead of taking careful aim. The rain started about dark. Huge drops at first, far apart enough that a body could ride between them if he took the time. They were warm, and Frank wouldn't have minded getting a little wet if they hadn't stung so hard each time they struck. Stormy pinned his ears back in annoyance, but pushed along into the storm as Frank pointed him in a wide circle so he could approach the wagon camp from the north along the swollen creek. Stormy was as good as they came when on the attack. The stout Appy was brazen in the face of gunfire and went boldly wherever Frank pointed him. About 200 yards away, he dismounted in the trees and made ready for his assault. First, he changed into a pair of moccasins so he could move more quietly and with greater speed. He tucked his boots into the pannier on the pack saddle and took out his two spare .45 Colts. Each was well oiled for storage. He wiped off some of the excess grease as he loaded each firearm, shielding them from the rain with his body. He hung one of the sidearms in a holster on his left side, in front of his razor-sharp sheath knife. The other he hung around the horn of Stormy's saddle, securing the holster with a leather wang in case things turned rodeo. He left the .44-40 rifle tucked in its scabbard in the saddle. It might come in handy if he got pinned down, but Frank didn't intend to let that happen. Instead, he got the double-barreled coach gun out of the pack saddle. He cracked it open to make certain each tube was free of any blockage, dropped in two paper shells of buckshot, and snapped it shut with a quick flick of his wrist. The sound of the street cannon clicking shut made his heart feel good. It was the perfect weapon for wanton killing, and Frank intended to give no quarter. He dropped a handful of extra shotgun rounds into the pocket of his hip-length leather coat. He'd save as many of the women as he could, but only the outlaws who ran stood a chance of getting out of this alive. Frank had heard of killers and rapists going free back east after slick-talking shyster lawyers pleaded their case for them with half-truths and twisted facts. There was no room for that here. If there was any pleading to be done for these men, it was going to have to be outside the gates of hell, because they'd never have time to see the inside of a courtroom. 2 hours after dark, the rain fell in sheets. Frank, drawing his leather coat up around him, moved on the horse like a ghost through the wind-whipped cottonwoods. Lightning periodically flashed across the plain. At each strike, Frank memorized the scene before him and made ready for his attack. So far as he could tell, there was only one guard, sitting with a piece of canvas pulled up over his face. The rest of the men had taken shelter in the wagons, leaving the women crowded into one. Lantern light and cigarette smoke poured from the three wagons where the men joked and played cards. The women's wagon was dark and quiet. They were making this much too easy. The wind slashed at the trees, and the wind blew rain with such a fury, Frank was able to ride within feet of the dejected canvas-covered guard. A flash of lightning split the darkness, and the gunfighter coughed quietly under his breath, causing the guard to turn and face the gaping barrels of the 12-gauge. The outlaw's head evaporated like an exploding melon. The shotgun's roar mingled with a roll of earth-shaking thunder. Frank dismounted before the body hit the ground, his eyes on the lighted wagons. He snapped open the greener's breech and dropped two fresh rounds into the tubes. He threw Stormy's reins around the back wheel of the dark wagon and poked his head under the flap, his finger to his lips. Both the Fossman girls screamed when they saw him, in spite of his warning. Dixie lit a match and held it up in tiny fingers, looking at him with pleading green eyes.
I knew you'd come back.
You bet. Quiet now. We can all get out of this alive.
Frank handed Dixie the dead guard's rifle.
You know how to use one of these?
I do.
Good. Stay tough. When the shooting starts.
Bert, everything okay?
One of the other outlaws had come to investigate. No doubt because of the Fossman twins screaming. Frank put a finger to his lips again and handed the shotgun to a trembling Paula Freeman. His knife hissed from the scabbard at his side.
Around here, checking on the prisoners.
Huh? Ferg, what the hell are you doing?
Oh.
It was Judith Fossman's killer. Frank pushed the knife in, sharp edge up, and drew the surprised man to him, ripping up through gut and lung.
A little tougher when it's not a helpless woman, isn't it, partner?
Frank lowered the body to the ground. He poked his head inside the wagon flap.
Are all you women accounted for?
Paula nodded and handed back the shotgun as if it might bite her. She was definitely out of her element.
Good. That makes my job a heck of a lot easier.
What job is that?
Slaughter. I intend to kill every last one of these murdering scum.
Good.
The way the wagons were circled, Frank was able to position himself halfway in between the two that looked to hold the largest number of outlaws. He slogged up in the mud and measured the distance, then took four extra shells out of his pocket for the shotgun. Two he put in his left hand, two he held in his teeth. Taking a deep breath, he aimed at the wagon to his left, about a foot above the sideboard. He had the element of surprise on his side, and he figured he could get four shots off before he had to face anyone. Fire spit from the short-barreled greener. Frank shot one barrel at a time, spinning to put one round into each of the two wagons to throw them into pandemonium before reloading to repeat the process. He was able to use up all six rounds before wounded and frightened outlaws began to fall and swarm out of the canvas like bees.
It's a posse!
Frank dropped the shotgun and cut him down with a round from his 45 as the man started for the horses.
Posse my ass! It's Morgan! Come back for the women just like Wilson said he would! Somebody locate that son of a bitch and kill him!
Frank rolled under a wagon full of dead outlaws as a volley of gunfire kicked up the mud at his feet. Evidently, two or three of the older men had been sleeping in one of the dark wagons away from their more boisterous partners. Frank thanked his lucky stars he picked the right wagon to look for the women. One of the gunmen came rushing around the wagon to the same side as Frank. He was obviously confused by the gunfire and storm. Frank drilled him in the belly. Another quick shot shut him up for good. Rifle fire erupted to his right, and Frank realized Dixie had found a clear shot. Horses squealed in the darkness, and hoofbeats echoed through the wind as the remaining outlaws fled into the night. After a few minutes, Frank climbed to his feet and counted the dead and wounded men. If his original estimate was correct, three had gotten away. 14 men lay in various stages of dying and death in and out of the tattered wagons. Once he felt certain the kidnappers had truly run off, he went to check on the women, He called out well in advance, so Dixie didn't shoot him in the darkness.
Hello, the wagon. It's me, Morgan.
Dixie stuck her head out of the canvas.
Is it over?
For now. Three slipped away, but I don't think they'll be back until they get some help. You ladies think you could help me get these mules harnessed? I believe we should put a little distance between us and this place, just to be on the safe side.
All the women nodded, looking relieved to have something productive to do. In less than an hour, the four wagons with intact canvas were hitched and eight outlaw horses were tied to the tailgates, their saddles and other tack stowed inside out of the weather. Mrs. Freeman sat in the driver's seat of the last wagon in line. She looked down at Frank and Dixie, who stood beside him.
What about the wounded? I can still hear them moaning.
Yeah, they'll soon be quiet enough. We were lucky here, Dixie. Very lucky. This ain't over. They'll likely be back, this time in force.
Betty Ellington patted the shotgun on the seat beside her.
They'll not take us again. I'll shoot my own daughter before I let her fall into the hands of those...
Dixie reached up and put a hand on the woman's knee.
Hush now, don't speak of such things. Mr. Morgan has a plan. It won't come to that.
A minute later, nearer Dixie's wagon, she turned and looked Frank in the eye.
You do have a plan, don't you, Frank?
Frank nodded. Then he did something he rarely did. He lied.
The plan? Well, you bet.
Three of the wounded outlaws were still alive and propped up against one of the wagons.
If I had time, I'd hang you proper, boys. The trees are in short supply out here. I reckon there's a slim chance some of you might survive your wounds. And I'm willing to trade you that chance for some information.
That's a piss-poor excuse for a trade.
Well, sir, you're a piss-poor excuse for a human being. So it all evens out. The way y'all treated those women, I ought to plug each one of you right now. Or let the women have a go at you. The way I see it, it's not just Indian women who got a knack for slowly hurting a man. It's women in general. Especially women who've been wronged.
I never laid a hand on them women. We was under orders not to touch them. Swan says they was worth too much money to spoil them.
Who's Swan?
Frank kicked at the young outlaw to keep his attention.
All right.
Shut up, Bobby, you fool kid. Are you Frank Morgan?
That's my name.
Who's with you?
Just me, boys.
I thought it was you.
Who's Swan? Where's Wilson? When's he coming back?
He's a powerful man, Mr. Morgan. He's got money and plenty of men to back his play. They got a place not far
from... Shut the hell up, Bobby!
The outlaw kicked out and connected with the boy's ribs. The boy fell silent. Alone now, the older outlaw glared at Frank.
Bobby was right about one thing, you son of a bitch. Swan has a bucket full of men to back his play. That I know for certain. He'll hunt you down wherever you go. You can count on that. And when he catches up to you, he's gonna rain down on you like hellfire.
Hellfire, sir, is something about which you will soon be intimately acquainted.
Frank rose and turned to walk away.
You aim to just leave me here?
I tried to trade with you. If all you can talk is trash, go talk it to the devil.
Frank climbed into the lead wagon and sat on the springy wooden seat beside Dixie.
You ladies got everything you need?
I think so. If we left anything behind, they can have it. Frank, did you find Virgil?
Frank nodded, staring straight ahead.
I did. Found all of them. And the Fossman woman.
The wagon lurched forward as the mules dug into the mud.
I want to turn us north and get us as far out of no man's land as I can before Wilson gathers his forces. We need to get to a town. Dodge isn't too far. I know people there. We can re-outfit. You ladies can decide what you're gonna do.
They just killed him, Frank. They herded him out into the open and shot him all. Even little Timmy Brandon. I don't think Carolyn will ever be the same. None of us will. They were gonna sell us, Frank. They were taking us into some town and they planned to sell us all. Even the baby girls.
Frank drove on through the mist, relying on the mule's night vision to steer them clear of obstacles. Soon, he was keenly aware of Dixie sleeping against his shoulder. He smelled the rain on her skin and the fragrance of the soap she'd used to wash her hair, felt the rise and fall of her chest as she sobbed in her sleep.